July, A.D. 64. Much of Rome is still smoldering. Hundreds of buildings have been completely destroyed in the voracious blaze that burned unchecked for over a week in Rome. Thousands of people were dead. As we learned last time, Nero spent huge sums of money to provide relief. He also tortured and murdered Christians, claiming that these blasphemers and atheists were to blame for the calamity. But ultimately, Nero was still held responsible by the general population. And in subsequent years, the chaos surrounding the emperor began to swirl at seemingly faster and faster speeds. The treasury was drained, Nero's parties became ever more decadent, the murder stacked up, rebellions proliferated in the provinces, and eventually, Nero exhausted both Rome and himself. The only thing that this whole autocratic system was meant to stop suddenly reemerged with a fury, and that is open civil war. The extravagant final years of Nero on this episode of the Pax Romana podcast. Episode 20, The Last Years of Nero. Although it was never completed, Nero's golden palace was still a wonder to behold. In fact, it was impossible to miss. Taking up anywhere between 100 and 300 acres, the palace grounds were so large that they essentially blocked movement through the center of Rome. You couldn't actually get through, and much of the space occupied by this golden palace was actually parkland, with forests and gardens, vineyards. There was even a man-made lake in the middle of the estate. The grounds would be populated by a range of exotic animals. And when you actually went into the palace, the very first thing you would have seen as a visitor was a massive 100-foot or more tall, colossal statue of the Emperor Nero himself. Now, when Nero was dead, much of the palace would be demolished, and this statue would be refashioned into a statue of the sun god. His name was Sol. And then it would be moved right next to Rome's massive Flavian amphitheater. That hadn't been built under Nero, but it would be built a few decades later. That amphitheater, by the way, you probably know as that iconic Roman building now called the Colosseum. But you probably didn't know that the reason we call that building the Colosseum is probably not because of how large the building was, but because Nero's Colossus was moved to stand next to it. And so the building took on the name of this giant, one-of-a-kind statue. But to go back to the Golden Palace, probably its most interesting feature was its dining room. And this circular open-air room stood high atop a tower. It provided panoramic views of the city of Rome. But most fascinating of all, the dining room, much like the Space Needle in the city of Seattle, Washington in the United States, rotated. That's right, Nero's dining room rotated. To build that room, Nero's architects used the exact same technology as in Caligula's palatial ships, the ones that I mentioned a few episodes ago that were found in the bottom of Lake Nemi. So there were large ball bearings lubricated with a fine clay placed in holes at the top of the tower, and then the dining room floor was on top of these ball bearings. This would allow the floor to rotate slowly. Now, what actually moved the floor? There was an aqueduct that brought regular running water, which likely turned a set of wheels and gears to make the room turn. We don't have those wheels and gears anymore. Almost the whole building was destroyed, but in 2009, the base for the rotating dining room was found, and it had holes in it that were the size of these large ball bearings, and that led to the theory as to how this thing actually worked. We also have a coin that was minted under Nero, which shows the tower, and it includes one of the most interesting inscriptions that I've ever seen on a Roman coin. It's just six letters and two words. Mac Aug. M-A-C-A-U-G. This is probably an abbreviation for this phrase, the Emperor's Machine. Unsurprisingly, building such extravagant architectural wonders put Nero's treasury under severe pressure. Only recently did we learn how bad things actually got. In the past couple of decades, numismatists, and numismatists, in case you don't know, are people who study coins. So a group of numismatists were granted permission to drill into several of the silver coins that were minted under Nero immediately following the Great Fire in the years 65, 66, 67, and 68. And what they discovered when they actually drilled into the coins was pretty interesting. These denarii, by the way, were supposed to be minted at a sterling silver standard. That is, a mix of about 92.5% silver and then the remaining 7.5% being copper. There would be a few trace metals and minerals, of course, in the coins. But when the numismatists drilled into the physical coins themselves, they realized there was a clever trick going on. Nero's mentors had changed the coin mixture, adding quite a bit of extra copper and removing silver. They debased the currency to stretch the dwindling supplies of silver under Nero into an increasing amount of coins. And Nero's mentors had hid this change by ensuring that the copper was mostly in the center of the coin, and then the surface of the coin was enriched with silver. So to the naked eye, it was impossible to tell the difference between the old sterling silver coins and the new debased coins. Numismatists also analyzed the trace elements in the new coins, and that revealed even more of the story of Nero's finances. The trace elements in the older coins before the debasement showed that those coins were composed of silver sources from lead ore, probably what is called galena. In other words, original new sources of silver. But the new debased coins showed a totally different trace element pattern. And if you look at the charts, it's a jumbled mess. And what this suggests is that Nero's mint had run out of silver and needed to recycle older Republican coins. These were nearly pure silver, and remint those into the debased coins. Now, the debasement of the Roman currency under Nero would actually have pretty far-reaching consequences, at least over the long term. The Roman government didn't have the same kind of debt instruments that modern states use to defer the costs of present spending onto future generations. Yes, this is what modern states do all the time. So essentially, though, for the Roman state, their main source of revenue was direct taxes and tribute collection. They couldn't just borrow from the future. But Nero's debasement offered a new way of funding government budgets. Nero's mentors debased the coins, minted more coins out of the same amount of silver, and it took a little bit of time for what they had done to be discovered. And so for just a little while, the government got away with spending more money than it really had. Now, subsequent emperors would try Nero's trick as well, and each time it worked, but the silver content in the Roman coinage gradually diminished each and every time this was done. And so by the 3rd century AD, the Roman silver coinage reached a point where there really wasn't enough silver in it to stretch, and the coins became ugly brown slugs of metal, some of them rejected outright by much of the population. So Nero's debasement inaugurated the drawn-out collapse of Rome's monetary system. But the Golden Palace wasn't all that Nero had blown so much money on. Nero was quite the partier. One of the most lavish of his parties is described in some detail by Tacitus, and I'll give you the full quotation. Quote, "Nero had a raft constructed on Agrippa's lake, put the guests on board, and set it in motion by having other vessels tow it. These vessels glittered with gold and ivory. Their crews were arranged according to age and experience in vice. Birds and beasts had been procured from remote countries and sea monsters from the ocean. On the margin of the lake were set up brothels crowned with noble ladies and on the opposite bank were seen naked prostitutes with obscene gestures and movements. As darkness approached, all the adjacent grove and surrounding buildings resounded with song and shone brilliantly with lights. That's Tacitus's Annals. Now, just so you know, sea monsters is probably not referring to mythical creatures, but probably just large or particularly exotic forms of aquatic life. We have another account of this party, by the way, from Cassius Dio. He even claims that the revelry got so out of hand that there were people that actually died at the party. Now, why was Nero partying so hard like this in the final years of his reign? This was just one of many parties that he threw. He may have been trying to forget about the tragedies and terrors that were mounting up faster and faster as the years were going on. Some of these affected him in a deeply personal way. So, for example, in the year following the Great Fire, that is AD 65, Nero lost his second wife, Sabina Poppaea, along with their four-month-old daughter. Poppaea was due to give birth to Nero's second child, but something happened, and we don't know exactly what it was. Several sources, including the often reliable Tacitus and also the later senator Cassius Dio, both claim that Nero kicked his wife Poppaea in the stomach, perhaps over an argument, and this brought on a deadly miscarriage. Now, maybe Nero did that, maybe he didn't, but we do know that Nero mourned Poppaea bitterly and, in the only way that he knew how, extravagantly, with a decadent funeral in which the emperor burned a year's supply of costly imported incense. And that year was just a bad year for Nero all around. Again, this is AD 65, because that was also the year in which a conspiracy to assassinate Nero became discovered. A member of the Senate was plotting to have Nero murdered and have himself appointed emperor. Now, unfortunately for this guy, the plot was quite complicated, and so he ended up involving a lot of other people, and all it took was one person to finally leak the information to Nero or somebody close to him. And so then Nero rounded up the accused conspirators, captured them, tortured them until they confessed. Some of them were then executed. Others were exiled. And we know about the plot, by the way, because eventually those exiles were recalled back to Rome, where they gave details of the plot that they had planned. Also caught up in the fallout from this conspiracy was Nero's former trusted advisor, Seneca, who Nero ordered to commit suicide. Obedient till the end, Seneca gathered his friends around him and wished them farewell before he took poison, opened up his veins, and then suffocated himself in a steam bath. Historians don't believe that Seneca was actually involved in the conspiracy. Rather, what seems to have been going on is that Nero was going after anyone that was associated with members of the conspiracy, and several had counted Seneca as their friend. Nero ordered many other people besides Seneca to commit suicide in this event as well. So for Nero, it seemed like Rome was becoming unsafe. Maybe it would be a good time to leave, and that's what he did. In 66 AD, Nero leaves the city of Rome to go to Greece. And in Greece, he went on tour, going from city to city, performing poetry and singing songs. The Praetorian Guard would be there in the audience, leading the crowd to applaud for Nero. Of course, making it clear at the same time that not showing sufficient enthusiasm for the emperor's performances might be construed as treason. The biographer Suetonius claims that, quote, while Nero was singing, no one was allowed to leave the theater, even for the most urgent reasons. And so it is said that some women gave birth to children there, while many who were worn out with listening and applauding secretly leapt from the walls, since the gates at the entrance were closed, or they feigned death and were carried out as if for burial. That's Suetonius' biography of the Emperor Nero. Now, while Nero was touring Greece, he met a slave boy named Sporus, and supposedly the boy's face reminded Nero of that of his recently deceased and heavily mourned wife, Poppaea. Now, as I said, I wonder if at least part of the reason Nero was away from Rome was to try to get over Poppaea. But seeing this boy was too much for Nero. And so he had Sporus castrated, held a mock wedding ceremony in which Nero was the husband and Sporus was the bride. Nero would then appear in public in Greek cities with the slave boy Sporus at his side. Only Sporus was dressed in the clothes of an empress. Most Roman nobility would see these kinds of things as debauched and debased. Moreover, this was all being done publicly and by the emperor of all people. It seemed like Nero reveled in licentious exhibition, in breaking the cultural and social norms and morals that first emperor, Augustus, had established as a hallmark of the new autocratic regime. That was part of the justification of this whole thing in the first place, that morals were supposed to be returned to Rome after so many decades of godless civil war. But by the time we get to Nero, we see cultural vandalism in full swing. Nero seemed to believe that smashing what others had created made him somehow powerful. It's a form of cultural narcissism, which often circles into prominence every few generations. At the same time, you almost can't blame Nero because no one made any serious attempt to stop him for years. While there were plots and conspiracies against Nero, there was certainly no senator advocating a return to the Republic or even to the days of Augustus. Instead, Nero was flattered everywhere he went, both in public and in the halls of the Senate, by crowds of cowards. But despite the applause that Nero received while touring Greece, things were in fact going very badly, very quickly. A second major revolt erupted while Nero was on tour, this time in Judea. In AD 66, Roman tax increases set off a riot in Jerusalem. The Roman governor attempted to raid the temple for payment, and he arrested several members of the Jewish ruling council. This body was called the Sanhedrin. The riot, of course, erupted now into full-blown rebellion. Roman forces in the city were either killed or expelled. The Roman client king, who would be the last of the Herodian dynasty of biblical fame, ended up fleeing the city as well. And so for a brief time, Jewish rule returned to parts of the Holy Land. Now, in response, Nero sent a rising military officer named Vespasian to go and quell the rebellion in Judea. Vespasian was a talented soldier and a capable commander, and his family had only very recently entered the Roman elite. So here was a man who likely knew his place, would be grateful for the position, and would serve his emperor with loyalty. But Vespasian would eventually get other ideas and harbor grander ambitions. But we'll check back on those in a few episodes. With the rebellion in Judea and all of Nero's personal problems, the deaths, the conspiracies, the decadence, the downward spiral was beginning to spin like a tornado. A second conspiracy now was formed. And this was while Nero was still in Greece. And again, word was leaked to the emperor before the assassination occurred. Nero began to make guesses as to who the ringleaders were, and so he rounded up several prominent men and also invited several governors of his western provinces to come and meet him in Greece. And when they arrived, Nero informed all of them, both those who were probably guilty, but also those who were almost certainly innocent, that they were all commanded to commit suicide. Again, this included many governors who likely had nothing to do with this or any other conspiracies. At this point, it must have been increasingly clear, even to those who had been loyal to Nero, that no one in Nero's empire was safe. Nero had to go. Events begin to move very fast now in AD 68. We know that Nero's freedmen, who he had left in charge of Rome, rushed to Greece to visit the emperor and warn Nero that there were rumors of rebellion in the west, swirling in the city of Rome. And so Nero bolted back to Rome, and in fact, not just one, but several governors declared that their soldiers had acclaimed them imperator, or commander. Now that title has significance, as you might remember. Imperator was the title that Augustus, back when he was still called Octavian, had used to justify commanding soldiers and eventually marching on Rome. And indeed, it seemed that it would be open season on the capital. It was just a question of which of these usurping governors would get there first. The winner ended up being the governor of the Spanish provinces. He was a strict disciplinarian, and his name was Galba. And by the year AD 68, Galba was 69 or maybe 70 years old. He was probably one of the few remaining Romans alive who had a living memory of the reign of Augustus. And so as Galba marched towards Rome, it became clear that Nero might very well be supplanted. And indeed, first Nero's own Praetorian Guard, and then the Senate, turned on the decadent emperor and recognized Galba as the legitimate ruler in Rome, even before he made it into the city. Nero fled Rome, but his soldiers soon stopped even taking his orders. So he found his way to a villa just outside the city, and there he had several slaves dig him a grave. Eventually, the hooves of the horsemen who were there to capture Nero could be heard just outside the villa. Now, Nero, even then, was not able to muster the courage to take his own life. And so he asked one of the men with him to go ahead and run him through with a sword. When the soldiers finally arrived and saw the scene, Nero was on the ground, bleeding to death, and he would go on to die on June 9th, AD 68. Nero had left no surviving children, and with him, the line of Augustus, Rome's first emperor, came to an end. The Pax Romana's first and founding dynasty was over. But as we'll learn in the next episode, Nero's death did not solve Rome's problems. In fact, the next year would see almost continuous civil war with Rome the prize. And it would be four different men who would fight it out for control, with only one of them earning the right to set up the Pax Romana's second imperial dynasty. Find out who the winner was and how he defeated the other claimants to the empire on the next episode of the Pax Romana podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Pax Romana podcast. For more information, including a list of primary sources and further reading, check the show notes. Music by Red Productions and Exacor. Follow Dr. Colin Elliott on X at ProfCPE or email colin@paxromanapodcast.com. Listen to more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or just about anywhere podcasts are available. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Pax Romana podcast.